Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also Radio Verulam in St Albans. Our guest this week is Colin McNamee. Colin is a regular contributor to Dialect and he's here to talk about the referendum coming up in May this year. We features from Anthony Page and Alec Milne on nuclear issues. Tony Gosling has presented us with a feature about local commercial radio. Malcolm Greaves reads the first chapter from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Eagle-eared listeners might notice we did broadcast this first chapter last week, but the show came out at an unusual time because of Easter. Some of you may have missed it, so this is a longer version of the first chapter that we played last week. Tim Burrows is also in studio with a poem, and Jeff Sparks is here as usual with the What's On Guys. I'm John Peters Coleman. Coming up, we have a feature on Bristol's involvement with the armament industry, nuclear energy and nuclear contamination. Anthony Page has been talking to Dr. Helen Caldicott, who visited Bristol recently.
It could happen tonight by computer error, by a flock of geese setting off the satellites, by hackers hacking into the early warning system in the Pentagon. It could happen like Fukushima did. So now we've got Fukushima, which is kind of nuclear war without the explosions. But if we have a nuclear war, like tonight, that's the end of all of us. That's why Bristol has to get out of this arms industry. And I say that on purpose.
But first, a song to start the show, and this is Dogs of War by Pink Floyd.
Thank you.
That was a track by the Pink Floyd, or The Floyd, called The Dogs of War. Time to welcome a guest now, Colin McNamee. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening.
Good evening to you too. Right, well, how are you feeling about the upcoming referendum in which we get the opportunity to vote for AV?
Oh, seriously underwhelmed. I really like being stitched up.
Okay, so you're probably not alone, because a lot of people were expecting a bit of a wider choice of options.
Yeah, it's something that there's been no demand by the electorate. The politicians didn't fully discuss it. They dismissed one of the better forms of AV, which was AV Plus, which came out of a 1997 Jenkins report. And the politicians decided that was too complicated for the electorate to understand. So they binned it.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Always nice to treat your audience as though they are intelligent. I suppose, really, we should just say a little bit about yourself. You are involved politically and you are a member of the United Kingdom Independence Party.
Indeed I am. Although at this stage, I'm not representing UKIP within this interview. UKIP are in favour of the AV, the alternative vote system, and that's what they're campaigning for. Although many of the members do not support that, and we're free to speak. So in this interview, I'm not speaking on behalf of UKIP, but I can explain whatever you wish to know about their policies.
OK, so what do you think led to UKIP thinking that this AV was going to be a good idea? Have they ever come up with strategies or policies about the voting system before now? Or is this just sort of, well, they're presenting us with a choice, so we better make one?
No, actually, UKIP had a policy on an alternative vote system for some 5-6 years ago, and it was published, and they were in favour of AV Plus,
right,
which is certainly more. AV, the alternative vote system, is not proportional representation. It's a preferential voting system.
Mm-hmm.
AV Plus, or AV Plus One as it was originally known, is more proportional representation. It is slightly more complicated, but it is certainly not as complicated as the campaign against AV would have you believe that the politicians are putting out. They really do think the electorate are thick, and you've just got to look at the way they're portraying AV, and it just isn't true.
Okay, so why are you not agreeing with UKIP? Why have you parted company?
No, I've not parted company with UKIP.
Well, on this issue.
A lot of people within UKIP are very independent-minded. We don't have whips that whip us into place.
Yeah.
Because I think AV is wrong for the country. It's wrong for our democracy. That's why I would urge people to not use the vote on the referendum and to boycott it.
Okay, what countries are there, or what examples are there where, you know, you can sort of see AV has not worked?
Well, I can tell you where AV is used. Mm-hmm. Australia use it.
Okay.
Papua New Guinea use it. So Papua New Guinea may not be a good option to use as an example, and the Australians are looking at changing from AV.
Okay, so Australians are not happy with the system that they have at the moment.
The politicians are looking at changing from the system. I don't know the details of Australian politics, but I do know they've used AV and they're not quite happy about the results they're getting.
Okay.
And John, remember that over there it's compulsory. You have to vote.
Right. How does this fit into an EU perspective? I mean, what sort of precedents have we got, you know, over on the continent for in terms of how voting is working?
Well, the EU system is proportional representation. The UK is divided into 12 regions.
Mm-hmm.
There is no constituency link in EU voting. It is genuine proportional representation. It's a closed party system. And without getting too complicated about it, it's a single vote and there are multi-MEPs within each regional constituency.
How does that affect what the representation for Britain looks like then, as opposed to what we've got at the moment, which is first past the post?
Well, one of the things with proportional representation as far as EU is concerned, and for example, now if I use UKIP as an example, UKIP came second nationally in the 2009 European elections with 2.4 million votes. We got 13 MEPs elected.
Mm-hmm.
We beat Labour, we beat the Lib Dems, and we came just behind the Conservatives.
So is it, you know, possibly not really much of a surprise that PR is not on the cards as something that people can vote for on the grounds that it might actually work and give smaller parties a greater say?
That was a very good question. I couldn't have put it better myself, and the answer is just as your question.
Yeah, okay, yeah, as I finished that, I thought so. I mean, the minor party is going to remain fairly minor, so why are UKIP bothering to vote for AV?
Because it is a small step to get political representation. In the general election last year, UKIP polled 918,000 votes. we have no MP. UKIP polled more than the Green Party, the BNP, the English Democrats, the Welsh Assembly, Northern Ireland Assembly and the Scots Assembly, all added together. UKIP polled more, and we have no representation in Parliament. So 918,000 people in this country are disenfranchised within the UK system, plus many people didn't vote for UKIP because they would view it as a wasted vote. Mm-hmm. And yet in the European election, we polled 2.4 million.
Right. I mean, would it not be the case if people did vote AV style, if it went through and they put, you know, an order of sort of preference who they like? You know, at least if their number one didn't get in, but their number two choice did, they wouldn't feel quite so disenfranchised. I mean, that's got to be better than what we've got at the moment, surely. So surely people...
Yeah, it depends how confident and trustworthy you feel our politicians are. Over the last 10 years, I mean, my trust in our UK political system is just about zero, based on the example. What you say has merit. AV offers also the possibility that if you just put one choice down and you forget about putting multi-choices down, and you just use it as a first-past-the-post system, so it's keeping the first-past-the-post. But the idea is that it is a preferential system which you don't have to use.
Right.
And it will not work really to the benefit of the smaller parties. It will still keep the major parties in position, which is why they've gone for AV and not AV plus, and certainly not for the most democratic system of total representation. And total representation is used nowhere in the world, but it is genuinely democratic.
Okay. I mean, would it not be the case, you know, if we had other systems apart from AV, sort of, you know, these proportional representation and total representation, that there's going to be wild fluctuations in who's inhabiting Parliament? I mean, that's going to greatly affect stability. Isn't stability very important?
Well, if you look over the last few years, the government has been elected by less than 35% of the electorate, so that's hardly representative. We've also had some very extreme forms of government, from Thatcher through Blair and Brown.
But what would it be like if, for example, the BNP had a successful election? If we had total or proportional representation, they might have a lot more people, like somebody in Parliament.
Yeah, so what? That's called democracy. I suspect, and I don't know, I suspect that they wouldn't get more than one or two in, and a lot of people would then vote for the likes of UKIP or the Green Party rather than BNP. So it would take them to the wire and put them to the test. I think they'll be found wanting. I really don't believe the British electorate is that extreme.
Okay. How have you chatted or discussed with other minor parties or people who are involved in other minor political parties? I mean, what is the ground feeling when you chat to people who are involved in politics?
Well, I haven't. Whether or not UKIP at senior level have, I don't know. But the feeling amongst the smaller parties from reading the media is that they are tending towards AV. Certainly the Greens and BNP, English Democrats, all seem to be going down the AV route. I, as an individual, think it's wrong. I've looked at many systems starting about 4 or 5 years ago. And to use the vote would be a mistake in this case, because the politicians will say, I guarantee it, will say in the future, we've offered the electorate a choice and they've chosen first past the post or AV. It doesn't matter. I feel that there will be a low turnout. And if I can persuade people not to vote, not to ruin the papers, not to write on it neither of the above, then I will have achieved something, because it then opens the door for the future to say to the politicians, it was such a derisory turnout, it is not democratic, it's unreasonable to have this system. Now give us something proper.
Is it not likely that they'll just accept, you know, whatever the vote is and then take it as that? So surely people should be trying to vote for something, at least some change that will sort of make politics at least a bit more interesting.
John, that's exactly my concern, that they will take whatever comes in. That's why when the Lord suggested, it's a major change within our democracy. This is our democracy, it's not their democracy. And the Lords wanted a 40% minimum coming in for turnout. The House of Commons rejected it. So I say, well, let's go all the way and reject it right down to zero. Then it's a derisory turnout. It has no validity.
There aren't really that many people, I've heard, sort of saying that we should do what you say. You know, isn't it likely to fall on deaf ears?
I don't know. How many listeners have you got?
Well, none of us know. Very good question. So when is the referendum, in case, you know, sort of people have completely forgotten?
May the 5th. And please don't use your vote. Don't spoil the paper. Don't vote.
Okay, well, Colin McNamee, thank you very much for your views and opinions. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Our next feature is by paediatrician Dr. Helen Caldicott. Here she talks about Bristol's involvement with the armament industry, nuclear energy and nuclear war. The intro music is a song by the Albion Band and it's called Tomorrow's Too Late.
Days of the fallout from Chernobyl drifting over Britain, all the samples from Cumbria exceeded the action level suggested for removing livestock from grazing out of doors. If an accident to a reactor over 1,000 miles away can wreak such havoc, then what would be the consequences if Sellafield were to go up?
Nobody thought we could lose things. Helen Caldicott, paediatrician, founding president, Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Can you tell us why you're here in Bristol, please?
Because I've been invited by a group of women to speak about the proposal that they want to build a very big new nuclear reactor some 10 miles from Bristol, and you've already got two there.
Has this got anything to do with the recent Japanese disaster?
Well, it didn't. I was invited maybe 4 months ago, 5 months ago, and I said yes, because I'd be in London, and then suddenly Fukushima happened. So it's just taken up all my time for the last 5 weeks.
Can you tell me just a bit about your background?
Yeah, I'm a paediatrician. My specialty is cystic fibrosis. I established the cystic fibrosis clinic at the Adelaide Children's Hospital in Australia. I worked on the faculty at Harvard in the CF clinic. I founded the Physicians for Social Responsibility in 1978, recruited 23,000 doctors, started similar medical groups all over the world, and we helped to end the Cold War. We got the Nobel Prize.
So can you tell us a bit about your stance on nuclear energy?
Nuclear energy is medically contraindicated. It's a cancer industry. It's an industry that will over time produce random compulsory genetic engineering forevermore and deformed children. And it's also a nuclear war industry. Apart from that, it's terrific.
Do you have a lot of the nuclear industry in Australia?
No, we don't have nuclear power in Australia. It's too dangerous for us. We just export uranium to the rest of the world. We've got 40% of the world's richest uranium in Australia, and the uranium in Fukushima is mostly probably Australian uranium.
Tell us about your book.
The first book I ever wrote was called Nuclear Madness. I was asked by the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine to write an article about the medical problems of nuclear power, and someone came to me and said, would you write a book? And I spent a year researching it, and I said, I never thought of writing a book. And he said, well, you can speak into a tape recorder. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I can, but it didn't work. So then I wrote it, Nuclear Madness, which instantly became a bestseller. And then I wrote Missile Envy about 5 years later, about the arms race in nuclear war. And it was a good title because all the generals hated the title, but they all had the book on their bookshelves. It's named after Freud, of course. And then the next book I wrote was If You Love This Planet, which was about global warming and toxic pollution, deforestation, desertification, ozone depletion, the whole thing. That was 1991, and it was predicted then what was going to happen with global warming. And I thought, well, I've written the book, everyone will read it, and they'll fix it. But they didn't. Then I wrote my autobiography called A Desperate Passion. Then I wrote The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's military-industrial complex, just before he went into Iraq, which was about the military-industrial complex and how much money spent on weapons in the Department of Death, I call it now, not defence. And that was a pretty good book, got very little attention. Then I wrote War in Heaven, about the weaponization of space and America's notion of fighting war in heaven. And here in Bristol, you're right in the middle of the arms race. You need to close it down. This is a death industry.
Can you tell us more about that then?
Well, yeah, you've got the major corporations here, and I don't know how you got them, but you've got them. You know, this city's built first on slave trade, and then it was funded partly by Will's Tobacco, which is a death-inducing industry, and now you've got the arms trade here. Now, the arms trade is the biggest trade in the world. After the oil crisis in 1972, I think, weapons replaced oil as the international form of commerce. It's very lucrative and it employs a lot of people, not nearly as many as if people were building renewable energy and the like and looking after the communities and the roads and everything else. And it's a wicked industry, wicked, and probably most of your corporations hail from the United States and you have no right to be hosting them or participating in it because we are still on the edge of a catastrophe, i.e. nuclear war and the end of all life on the planet, because of the 25,000 nuclear weapons in the world, Russia and America own 97%, many of which are on hair trigger alert, which would take a 3-minute decision time by Putin or Obama to launch a nuclear war would be over in an hour. It could happen tonight by computer error, by a flock of geese setting off the satellites, by hackers hacking into the early warning system in the Pentagon. It could happen like Fukushima did. So now we've got Fukushima, which is kind of nuclear war without the explosions. But if we have a nuclear war, like tonight, that's the end of all of us. That's why Bristol has to get out of this arms industry. And I say that on purpose. And also, they're putting weapons in space to kill people from space. Oh, it's great.
Going back to the nuclear issue, do you think the disaster in Japan has made people realise that Chernobyl was not a one-off incident?
Yes. The Japanese have been sitting on the data, and has the Japanese government. They've finally come out and said, actually, it's pretty bad. We don't know when it's going to end. It could take 10 years to fix or longer. There could be an explosion. As a physicist I know said, it's like hanging off the edge of a precipice by your fingernails.
The future looks a bit bleak. Have you got any light at the end of the tunnel? Can you see any change in government attitude?
Oh, I think Fukushima is going to mean the end of the nuclear power industry and uranium mining. I just hope it has ramifications on the weapons industry. But it will be up to the media. And I don't trust the media, particularly my colleague from Australia, Rupert Murdoch. I just think the media is totally irresponsible and really criminal in not teaching people actually what the reality of their world is. Fukushima is going to produce hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of cases of cancer if it goes on the way it's going. I mean, have you ever helped a child die of cancer? We doctors are on the coalface of life and death. It's what we deal with every day. That's what life's about. It's not about how many lights you can turn on. Are we going to kill the earth for money? Looks like we are at the moment. And why are most politicians men? Where are the women? Why don't we stand up and get a bit of guts? Oh, yeah, the last book I wrote too, I forgot, was called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, and that's very relevant to now. My website is nuclearfreeplanet.org, and you'll get a lot of information from that.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott there talking to Anthea Page during her recent trip to Bristol. Our next feature is by Alec Milne. It's a speech recorded at the unveiling of a blue plaque to Canon Hardwick Rawnsley, one of the original co-founders of the National Trust.
I'm Nicola Watt, here representing the National Trust at the unveiling of a blue plaque to honour Canon Rawnsley at the community of the Sisters of the Church in St Paul's in Bristol. His description of Bristol at the time was not a pretty one, so it must have been quite a contrast to go to the Lake District. He could so easily have chosen when he got there to have led a quiet life, ministering to his congregation and enjoying the beautiful countryside around him. Instead, he chose to become involved in and instigate many things. For example, he was involved in the foundation of a nursing association, as well as several schools, including the School of Industrial Art in Keswick, where he and his wife organised courses in wood carving, metalwork and weaving as a counter to the local unemployment there. He was a great traveller and went to Moscow for the coronation of the Tsar. He became chaplain to the king. He wrote over 30,000 sonnets and published more than 40 books, many of them on the Lake District itself. He was also a great influence on Beatrix Potter, having met her for the first time when she was only 16, later encouraging her to publish her first book, Peter Rabbit. On top of that, Rawnsley was a great campaigner for the preservation of places of natural beauty. He formed the Lake District Defence Society, which later became Friends of the Lake District, and he resurrected the Keswick and District Footpath Association. So not only did he campaign relentlessly for the protection of these special places, but he also campaigned to maintain and improve access to them. He believed strongly in the importance of access to the countryside for city dwellers and factory workers, and lectured on the preservation of footpaths in London and other major cities. All this culminated in perhaps his greatest achievement, that of forming the National Trust in 1895, along with Octavia Hill, a social reformer, and Sir Robert Hunter, a lawyer and fellow campaigner. They formed it to preserve places of natural beauty and historic interest for all to enjoy, and that is still its main purpose today. For many years now, however, I think the public's perception of the Trust has moved away from the countryside he campaigned to save and been more focused on the great mansions that you have to pay to visit. And there has been a sense of being allowed to see but not touch. However, being closely involved with the Trust myself now for a number of years, I am very aware that people's perceptions of the Trust lag somewhat behind reality. Along with the 200 or so buildings the Trust owns, it cares for over 600,000 acres of countryside and over 600 miles of coastline, the majority of which is free to access. There is also a real move away from the see but don't touch feel of the past to a much more engaging experience, not just for visitors, but also for local communities, partnerships, and the thousands of volunteers that regularly get involved at properties all over the country. There is a real awareness within the Trust that it owns and manages an amazing resource, and that it is our responsibility and desire to make it easier for everyone, not just National Trust members, to take advantage of what we have. So on top of wanting people to visit and have a great day out, we want to build partnerships. We want to offer opportunities for people to get involved if they want to. But above all, we want people to enjoy themselves and to benefit in whatever way they want from their visit and from their involvement. We are particularly fortunate here in Bristol in having Tintersfield so close, only 6 miles to the west. Tintersfield is at the forefront of the changes happening in the National Trust, with over 700 local people volunteering in a variety of different roles there, not just the traditional and visible room steward role. The staff and volunteers are working with numerous and very diverse community groups and are doing things that I think would surprise many, but that are really getting people excited about the Trust and what it is doing and can offer. They have worked in partnership with the Rambert Contemporary Dance Company to create a unique modern dance performance inspired by Tintersfield and performed there. Not the sort of thing that would normally come to mind when you think of a Trust property. Other examples include working with young offenders, encouraging apprenticeships and work placements, as well as organising lots of innovative activities for people to enjoy. What they have achieved is being used as a role model for other Trust properties, as well as for other organisations, and I think it is well worth a visit if you haven't already been, and also worth seeing how community groups you are involved with could benefit from what the Trust has to share.
Thank you very much to Alec Milne there for that recording on the unveiling of a blue plaque to commemorate the life of Canon Hardwick Rawnsley, one of the co-founders of the National Trust. Now time for a repeat, no less, but we do have a good reason for it. It's chapter one again of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. This is a longer version of the recording we put out last week. The show went out at an unusual time last week because it was Easter, so a lot of people probably didn't hear it, so we put it out again. Treasure Island is no less an adventure story, did you know that? Narrating a tale of pirates and buried gold. However, it was first published in May 1883, and it was originally serialised by the children's magazine Young Folks between 1881 and 1882 under the title of Treasure Island or The Making of the Hispaniola, and it was put out under the pseudonym Captain George North. Did you know that? The novel is divided into 6 parts and 34 chapters. Jim Hawkins is the narrator for the majority of the book, except for chapters 16 to 18, which are narrated by Dr. Livesey. It is one of the most frequently dramatised books and has never been out of print. The intro music we've used is Symphony No. 3, The Pastoral Symphony by Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 1, The Old Sea Dog at the Admiral Benbow. Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey and the rest of these gentlemen, having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there is still treasure not yet lifted, I take up my pen and go back to the time when my father ran the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the brown old seaman with the sabre cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a hand barrow. A tall, strong, heavy nut-brown man, his tarry pigtail falling over the shoulders of his soiled blue coat. His hands ragged and scarred with black, broken nails, and the sabre cut across one cheek, a dirty, livid white. I remember him looking round the cove and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out into that old sea song that he sang so often afterwards. 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. In the high old tottering voice that seemed to have been turned and broken at the capstan bars. Then he rapped on the door with a bit of stick like a handspike that he carried, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste, and still looking about him at the cliffs and up at our signboard. "This is a handy cove," says he at length, "and a pleasant city 80 grog shop." "Much company, mate?" My father told him no. Very little company, the more was the pity. "Well then," said he, "this is the berth for me." "Here you, matey," he cried to the man who trundled the barrow. "Bring up alongside and help up my chest." "I'll stay here a bit," he continued. "I'm a plain man. Rum and bacon and eggs is what I want, and that head up there for to watch ships off. What you mought call me?" "You mought call me Captain." "Oh, I see what you're at. Here," and he threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I've worked through that," says he, looking as fierce as a commander. And indeed, bad as his clothes were and coarsely as he spoke, he had none of the appearance of a man who sailed before the mast, but seemed like a mate or skipper, accustomed to be obeyed or to strike. The man who came with the barrow told us the mail had set him down the morning before at the Royal George, that he had inquired what inns there were along the coast, and hearing ours well spoken of, I suppose, and described as lonely, had chosen it from the others for his place of residence. And that was all we could learn of our guest. He was a very silent man by custom. All day he hung around the cove or upon the cliffs with a brass telescope. All evening he sat in a corner of the parlour next to fire and drank rum and water very strong. Mostly he would not speak when spoken to, only look up, sudden and fierce, and blow through his nose like a foghorn. and we and the people who came about our house soon learned to let him be. Every day, when he came back from his stroll, he would ask if any seafaring men had gone by along the road. At first we thought it was the want of company of his own kind that made him ask this question. But at last we began to see that he was desirous to avoid them. When a seaman put up at the Admiral Benbow, as now and then some did, making by the coast road for Bristol, he would look in at him through the curtained door before he entered the parlour, and he was always sure to be as silent as a mouse when any such was present. For me, at least, there was no secret about the matter, for I was in a way a sharer in his alarms. He had taken me aside one day and promised me a silver fourpenny on the first of every month if I would only keep my weather eye open for a seafaring man with one leg, and let him know the moment he appeared. Often enough, when the first of the month came round and I applied to him for my wage, he would only blow through his nose at me and stare me down. But before the end of the week, he was sure to think better of it, bring me my fourpenny piece, and repeat his orders to look out for the seafaring man with one leg. How that personage haunted my dreams, I need scarcely tell you. On stormy nights, when the wind shook the four corners of the house and the surf roared along the cove and up the cliffs, I would see him in a thousand forms and with a thousand diabolical expressions. Now the leg would be cut off at the knee, now at the hip. Now he was a monstrous kind of a creature who had never had but the one leg, and that in the middle of his body. To see him leap and run and pursue me over hedge and ditch was the worst of nightmares. And altogether I paid pretty dear for my monthly fourpenny piece, in the shape of these abominable fancies. But though I was so terrified by the idea of the seafaring man with one leg, I was far less afraid of the captain himself than anybody else who knew him. There were nights when he took a deal more rum and water than his head would carry, and then he would sometimes sit and sing his wicked old wild sea songs, minding nobody. But sometimes he would call for glasses round and force all the trembling company to listen to his stories or bear a chorus to his singing. Often I have heard the house shaking with yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, all the neighbours joining in for dear life with the fear of death upon them, and each singing louder than the other to avoid remark. For in these fits he was the most overriding companion ever known. He would slap his hand on the table for silence all round. He would fly up in a passion of anger at a question, or sometimes because none was put, and so he judged the company was not following his story. Nor would he allow anyone to leave the inn until he had drunk himself sleepy and reeled off to bed. His stories were what frightened people worst of all. Dreadful stories they were, about hanging and walking the plank, and storms at sea, and the dry tortugas, and wild deeds and places on the Spanish main. By his own account, he must have lived his life amongst some of the wickedest men that God ever allowed upon the sea. And the language in which he told these stories shocked our plain country people almost as much as the crimes that he described. My father was always saying the inn would be ruined, for people would soon cease coming there to be tyrannised over and put down and sent shivering to their beds. But I really believe his presence did us good. People were frightened at the time, but on looking back they rather liked it. It was a fine excitement in a quiet country life, and there was even a party of the younger men who pretended to admire him, calling him a true sea dog and a real old salt, and such like names, and saying there was the sort of man that made England terrible at sea. In one way, indeed, he bade fair to ruin us, for he kept on staying week after week, and at last month after month, so that all the money had long been exhausted. And still my father never plucked up the heart to insist on having more. If ever he mentioned it, the captain blew through his nose so loudly that you might say he roared, and stared my poor father out of the room. I have seen him wringing his hands after such a rebuff, and I am sure the annoyance and the terror he lived in must have greatly hastened his early and unhappy death. All the time he lived with us, the captain made no change whatever in his dress but to buy some stockings from a hawker. One of the cocks of his hat having fallen down, he let it hang from that day forth, though it was a great annoyance when it blew. I remember the appearance of his coat, which he patched himself upstairs in his room, and which, before the end, was nothing but patches. He never wrote or received a letter, and he never spoke with any but the neighbours, and with these, for the most part, only when drunk on rum. The great sea chest, none of us had ever seen open. He was only once crossed, and that was towards the end, when my poor father was far gone in a decline that took him off. Dr. Livesey came late one afternoon to see the patient, took a bit of dinner from my mother, and went into the parlour to smoke a pipe, until his horse should come down from the hamlet, for we had no stabling at the old Benbow. I followed him in, and I remember observing the contrast the neat, bright doctor with his powder as white as snow, and his bright, black eyes and pleasant manners, made with the coltish country folk, and above all with that filthy, heavy, bleared scarecrow of a pirate of ours, sitting far gone in rum with his arms on the table. Suddenly he, the captain that is, began to pipe up his eternal song.
15 men on a dead man's chest, yo ho ho and a bottle of rum, drink and the devil have done for the rest. Yo, ho, ho, and a bottle of rum.
At first I had supposed the dead man's chest to be that identical big box of his upstairs in the front room, and the thought had been mingled in my nightmares with that of the one-legged seafaring man. But by this time we had all long ceased to pay any particular notice to the song. It was noon that night to nobody but Dr. Livesey, and on him I observed it did not produce an agreeable effect, for he looked up for a moment quite angrily, before he went on with his talk to old Taylor the gardener, on a new cure for the rheumatics. In the meantime, the captain gradually brightened up at his own music, and at last flapped his hand on the table before him in a way we all knew to mean silence. The voices stopped at once, all but Dr. Livesey's. He went on as before, speaking clear and kind, and drawing briskly at his pipe between every word or two. The captain glared at him for a while, flapped his hand again, glared still harder, and at last broke out with a villainous low oath,
"Silence there! Between decks!"
"Were you addressing me, sir?" says the doctor. And when the ruffian had told him with another oath that this was so, "I have only one thing to say to you, sir," replied the doctor, "that if you keep on drinking rum, the world will soon be quit of a very dirty scoundrel." The old fellow's fury was awful. He sprang to his feet, drew and opened a sailor's clasp knife, and balancing it open on the palm of his hand, threatened to pin the doctor to the wall. The doctor never so much as moved. He spoke to him as before, over his shoulder, and in the same tone of voice, rather high so that all the room might hear, but perfectly calm and steady. "If you do not put that knife this instant in your pocket, I promise upon my honour that you shall hang at the next assizes." There followed a battle of looks between them, but the captain soon knuckled under, put up his weapon, and resumed his seat, grumbling like a beaten dog. "And now, sir," continued the doctor, "since I now know there's such a fellow in my district, you may count I'll have an eye upon you day and night. I'm not a doctor only, I'm a magistrate, and if I catch a breath of complaint against you, if it's only for a piece of incivility like tonight's, I'll take effectual means to have you hunted down and routed out of this. Let that suffice." Soon after, Dr. Livesey's horse came to the door and he rode away. But the captain held his peace that evening, and for many evenings to come.
Our muchly thanks to Malcolm Grieve, who read wonderfully Chapter 1 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2, next week. How local is commercial local radio? You may not realise it, but local radio stations like Heart have been slowly merging over the last 15 years, so while they operate on local radio licences, they are no longer local, but either regional or national. Ofcom, who are supposed to regulate these licences, have chosen a light-touch approach to the issue. Anyway, the demise of commercial local radio was discussed at the recent conference of the National Union of Journalists, which took place in Southport. Our Tony Gosling spoke to radio journalist Peter Behan.
My name is Peter Behan. I sit on the Broadcasting Industrial Council with the NUJ. And the motion we've just moved was on this worrying trend, as I see it, the demise of commercial radio in the regions, in which we're seeing local stations swallowed up by conglomerates and turning into large regional stations that don't reflect their local identity and not close to their local communities anymore. I worked in independent local radio, as I prefer to call it really, than commercial radio, because it's localness that I find important here. I worked in the 1990s when this consolidation was beginning. We were seeing I worked in Leicester for the station there, a station with a proud tradition of serving its local community. But even then, we were beginning to see this trend of more networked programmes, shorter news bulletins, even pre-recorded bulletins, which was a worrying trend, I thought. But this is now continuing at a pace. We're seeing it far more. These stations are being swallowed up. We've seen in my part of the world, in the East Midlands, we've seen three stations serving Nottingham, Leicester, Derby, all disappear. All that have had, I say, a long tradition of serving those cities, now under the mantle of Capital FM. I mean, if that isn't an indictment of local radio, Capital FM for the East Midlands, what is? So to me, it's very worrying. It sees an erosion of local news, erosion of local accountability, and certainly for when we're talking about journalists who produce that news, jobs going.
Well, it's peculiar, isn't it? Because these stations are still applying for the individual licences, and yet almost as if it was one giant station applying for lots of little licences.
That's right, yes. I mean, they still maintain this sort of aura of localness, saying, you know, this is a regional service, but
isn't there actually something in that license that says they actually do have to be an independent local station?
Well, that's it. I mean, certainly they have to, the license agreements require they provide certain hours of local programming, which should be enforced by the regulator Ofcom. But as we've seen to date, Ofcom is letting these companies get away with all sorts in terms of their news provision. And as I mentioned in my speech in the hall, I mean, we're seeing bulletins of less than 60 seconds. You know, I mean, at peak times of the day, how is that local news provision? From a listener's point of view, they can spin the illusion of these things still being local by using idents and sort of trails and stings to make it feel to listeners if they're still getting their local news service, when of course it may be coming from hundreds of miles away. But if you're telling me that you can still provide a local news service for Nottingham from Manchester or whatever, then I just think that's nonsense.
But isn't this kind of inevitable since advertising is going down, advertising revenue is going down?
Certainly, yeah, money's being cut, but I think you'll find that the big players involved here, the globals and so on, are still making pretty healthy profits there, so there's money there if they want to put it into local news.
So what you're saying is that maybe it's going to bosses and shareholders rather than going into providing the service?
Those people are certainly coming first, yeah.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling and Peter Behan. That was radio journalist Peter Behan talking to Dialect. Tim Burrows is here in the studio. He does have a poem, however, in a slight departure. It's a sort of a nice musical tune. He's got his guitar set up, ready to play, and then he will recite poetry over the top. Tim, hello.
Hi.
Do you want to just sort of get stuck right in?
Yeah, this is about learning music and about learning from other players and why maybe we like, you know, art and music. Phrases, licks from the greats, echoes and scales of brilliance, formed and shaped by long nights and days of practice. Performance, listening, absorbing, copying, reforming. Hard tip fingers bleed. special world that some call art, but others call spirituality. The pulse of imagination forming a bridge. Gilt, golden, molten, shining like the stars. Reflecting the smallness of each and everyone's existence. The film of life, the shadow of existence. The slow, ponderous track. The human tread. Films of dust on the petri glass of passing time. I like picking phrases, licks from the grates, echoes of scales of brilliance.
Well, that was incredibly relaxing. A little round of applause in the studio there for Tim Burrows. It is Sunday at about 12 o'clock when this goes out on the radio. The Bristol Folk Festival will still be going on at the Colston Hall. That might be worth going to check out if you've got nothing to do for the rest of the afternoon. Are you going to be seen anywhere publicly?
On soon? Friday. Friday service before. So I'm performing at Friday and 3:30 in the second stage, but with Trevor Carter. Okay. As well, Trevor Carter, Charles Thompson and David C. Johnson. So that's with Di Taylor's films as well.
Okay, so depending on you know, when you're listening to this, it might already be too late, but if it's not, go and check it out. Tim Burrows, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Time once again for What's On. Jeff Sparks, over to you now.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 6th of May, N-Dubs will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 6 p.m. and tickets are £20 in advance. On Saturday, 7th of May, The Moles will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Sly and the Family Stone. This is from the album There's a Riot Going On, which was released in 1971, and it's the track Family Affair.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
What a bear. What a bear. Still checking each other out. Hey, nobody wants to blow. Nobody wants to be left out. You can't leave 'cause your heart is there. But you can't stay 'cause you've been somewhere else. You can't cry 'cause you look broke down, but you're crying anyway, 'cause you're all broke down. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair. Oh, yeah, family affair.
Family affair.
That was Sly and the Family Stone with Family Affair from the album There's a Riot Going On. On Sunday, 8th of May, John Pearce and friends will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on 8th of May, The Defiled will be performing with support from Romeo Must Die at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Excellent choice of tune of the week. And don't all rush out and buy N-Dubs tickets all at once, will you? Right, that's all from Dialects this week. Studio guest was Colin McNamee. Features were by Tony Gosling, Anthony Page and Alec Milne. And Malcolm Greave read excellently the first chapter of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. The poem, set to a pleasant tune, was by Tim Burrows. The What's On was by Jeff Sparks. The engineer was Michael Noyce. The presenter was John Peters Coleman. And the producer was Anthony Page. So, to you all, and goodbye, and enjoy your week.
Over the land, plumes of smoke rise, merge into the leaden sky.